Paper. Welcome to episode 97 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today I'm talking with Bruce Foster, a paper engineer who has engineered over 65 pop-up books, over 100 pop-up cards, and at least a dozen other unpublished works. Originally from southern Louisiana, Bruce attended art school at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, earning his BFA with honors and returning later for graduate studies in studio art. Eventually settling in Houston, Texas, he worked as a graphic designer and art director before discovering and launching a career in movable books in 1989, although it wasn't until 2005 that he had enough full-time work to take it full-time. Enjoy our conversation.
Well, Bruce Foster, welcome to Paper Talk.
I'm glad to be here, Helen.
Yeah. I think we met several years ago through Sean Sheehy, and he gave me your name as a great artist to contact to contribute a project to my book, Playing with Pop-Ups.
Yeah, that's been a while.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, close to 10 years, maybe 8. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to hearing about your journey with paper. So tell me just a little bit about your background and any creative pursuits.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Louisiana originally. I was from a small town north of Baton Rouge called St. Francisville, which is a very plantation, antebellum home town. It was kind of like an Opie kind of a childhood, very small town. One flashing red light was the entire city.
Wow.
You know, kind of thing. I have two younger brothers, both of them deceased now, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. My father was a mechanic. My mother is a florist. And I was a very shy, introverted child who read lots of comic books and read lots of sci-fi novels. So that was my outlet.
Where did you get those books? Did you go to the library or...
The library was very important to me. And we lived way out in the country at first. And the bookmobile would come to our, because we were in the rural country. And I loved going to the bookmobile. I would go, there's just this little van. People probably don't even know what bookmobiles are anymore. But they would bring a little library out to the countryside. And I would go on there and I just loved the smell of the books. And I would just pick out several books, and I would take them home and read them, and then eagerly wait for that bookmobile to show up again. But I'll tell you, my whole journey really started in the fifth grade, because I remember sitting there in the school library, and I looked up and I saw these three brightly colored cloth covered books, and they each had bright foil stamp of some weird emblem or something. I pulled that down. And it was the Lord of the Rings. And so I was mesmerized. Not only did I love the story of Lord of the Rings, I was already an avid reader and a really good speller and all that kind of stuff. I had won spelling bees and stuff. But that book, not only did it ignite my passion for books, really, but it also ignited my passion for art, because those foil stamps on there were elven rings. And I would copy those things over and over again. And that started giving me the feeling that graphic design and emblems and drawing and things like that were important.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on to that. So much the same way that the movies came out, I read Lord of the Rings first and then went back and read The Hobbit. But that was my beginning of my interest in art and graphic design and the larger world of children's publishing. So somewhere, I was around 15 years old. My parents divorced, and we moved to Tennessee at that point, moved to Nashville. So I had 2 years in high school there in Nashville, which was great. I loved Tennessee. It was so different from Louisiana. Uh-huh. And it gave me a chance to do a little bit of self-reinventing, stretch my wings a little bit. And I was, since I told you, I was already interested in drawing and stuff, but I doodle all the time. My mom says, why don't you take an art class? I went, I'm kind of shy, and especially in a new place.
Right.
But she says, no, take an art class. So I went in, and the class has already started, and the teacher had this big giant pile of sticks on this table and said, we're going to do a still life of these sticks today. And I went to, and I said to myself, why would I want to draw a bunch of sticks? And I quit the class. And I went across the hall and I took a class called mechanical engineering instead. Now, mechanical engineering teaches you, oftentimes they would give you the two sides of an odd object. And in your mind, you have to rotate this thing around to draw the third side, the hidden side.
Right.
And that gave me the ability, in hindsight, to do the kind of paper engineering, to visualize things before I actually draw them out. So the next year, I took architectural design and did some of that for a little while because I was really unsure about what I wanted to do. I was always interested in sci-fi and fiction, you know, that kind of thing. So I started school as a pre-med major. And interestingly enough, I had to work my way through. And one of the things they gave me as a work study kind of a thing was to work in a lab that was for microbiology graduate students and professors. So there was a dozen people all over the world, Taiwan and Russia and Argentina and Colombia, I mean, all over India. And so I would stand there at this facing a wall and scrub these test tubes for hours. and so these professors would come by and they would start talking to me and stuff. And here I was, this really dumb little kid from Louisiana, Tennessee, didn't know anything beyond my small bubble of the world.
Right.
So they started questioning me and giving me things to think about and asking me, pointing out to me that there's a worldview, and started expanding my mind.
Right. And where was this?
This is in Knoxville, University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's where I went to college. Loved it. I really loved college. It was a beautiful time. But this might make you laugh, but my roommate introduced me to the art program they had there because he was dating a girl and they said, they have live drawing there. And I went, okay, I'll try that. Anyway, so I walked in and first year you can't do that. It's a sophomore program. Just figure model, you know,
right.
Figure
model yep. stuff.
But I walked in and it was my first nighttime class as well. So it was kind of a romantic thing for me. It's like memory. It was an old building in the University of Tennessee, and all these easels were around and chairs and platforms that models would stand on and stuff. And I'm sitting there waiting for the class to start. And then the hippiest looking guy in the class with long hair and a beard stood up and said, well, let's get started. And I went, oh my God, I'm hooked. I'm so hooked on art at this point. So I started taking drawing classes and there was a real journey, not only in technique and things like that, but also art history and learning about where things came from and what had been done in the past. Cause I had a very, very limited education in this direction, but it also gave me a chance to open my mind about other things, you know, other world, you know, other points of view and things. But I had to hedge my bets because I wasn't sure about this art thing. Mm-hmm. So I also took graphic design classes and said, I have a fallback thing. I'm going to take graphic design classes. And I went through college and I ended up with my BFA. I went back to Nashville and I was working as a assistant art director, graphic designer for different firms. I worked for Vanderbilt Public Relations Office for a while, and I worked for a banking marketing firm for a while. But I said, I really want to do art. That's what I really want to do. So I went back to school to take some graduate classes. Now, I didn't apply. I just went back and I just showed up at art classes for graduate school. And they went, you're not supposed to do it that way. You're supposed to apply for the program. I went, I just want to do it. And they said, okay, well, you can take classes for a while and then we'll see what happens. And at the end of that first year, they invited me to be a part of the program. So at this point is when I was drawing and painting. But at this point, I started having friends who were sculptors. And they were in the program. And I thought they were more fun. They were a lot more fun than the painters were. They were very, very just very free kind of gypsy-like friends and stuff. And we'd have parties, and we would sit around fires, you know, and have the beer, for instance. We'd just have the word beer written up the side of the can because we were very poor. So we bought the generic stuff.
Right.
Can you even buy that anymore? I don't know. Anyway, so I started appreciating sculpture, and my paintings became very three-dimensional. They became large. They were shapes. They were trapezoidal shapes. Then I started branching out into found objects, wood branches. I would tie it together, and I would introduce other objects and things like that. So I really liked three-dimensional.
Yeah.
I didn't finish college. I had a life-changing experience, went through a divorce, and I started traveling for a while. Uh-huh. And I was so lost emotionally for a while that I didn't do any artwork. Mm. I was working in restaurants and things like that, traveling around the country. Went back down to New Orleans for a while. Ended up in Florida, where I met my current wife, a beautiful girl. So she was a kind of a dead ringer for Stevie Nicks. And I always had a crush on Stevie Nicks. Now I have a permanent crush on Lori. But for many, many reasons. For many reasons. But anyway, so eventually she got transferred. Oh, here's a funny story. She didn't know I had an art degree. And I had a whole portfolio of things, but I just didn't even want to deal with that at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the roommate I was staying with pulled it out and showed her one day when I wasn't there.
Mm.
She was furious. She was furious. Here I was working in restaurants and bars and things like that instead of pursuing my art. And she insisted that I get my act back together again. And I did. I started freelancing and doing some graphic design work. And then she was a regional manager for a retail chain. And she was very good at going into troubled markets and cleaning them up, you know, when there's bad employees and things like that. They transferred her to Houston, and that's how we ended up in Houston.
Okay.
And we got married, had a couple of daughters. I found out I really like being a dad. So growing up with the girls, I guess I grew up with them as well. But anyway, we would have reading time. Every night I would read at least an hour, maybe longer for those girls. I would get all these children's books and I would read them and read them and read them. Well, I was freelancing and doing graphic design work here in Houston. And then this is how I got into pop-ups. One of my clients was High C Juices. Mm-hmm. And they came to us and they said, we want to do something to introduce this new product that we're about to hit the stores with. So we need to send a marketing piece out to the grocery stores because they need to clear out a whole new section of the shelf. And shelf space is very, very valuable territory in a grocery store. The people, these products fight for these spots.
Right.
Higher up to close to your eyeballs, the better. But so I said, they said, well, the Super Bowl had just had a commercial for Coca-Cola where they did a 3D thing and they had glasses inside the 12 packs. Oh, and it was in San Francisco and it was all 3D. You watch the commercial with these glasses on. It was 3D. And they said, can we do something 3D? And I said, well, sure. I mean, I love 3D stuff, but what do you mean? And they said, can you do a pop-up? And I thought first to myself, what's a pop-up? I'd only seen one and it was just a cone before that. It was an imitation. So I didn't understand. But, oh, yeah, sure I can. Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely.
Uh-huh. What and year so was this?
About this was 1989.
Okay.
1989.
Yeah.
And so they said, I'm going to throw all kinds of 3D things at you. I went into the red, got the red green glasses. I tried them on and I figured out how to do a mock-up in 3D with the glasses on. I did a cover that was a optical illusion kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And on the inside, I proposed, to doing this pop-up. So the pop-up was for this brand new product they're putting in the stores and it was called a juice box. Mm-hmm. The very first time any company introduce a juice in a juice box that had shelf life. Now, interestingly enough, in Knoxville, a couple of years earlier, they had the World's Fair there. And that's where it was introduced, but it was introduced by the milk industry. So Hi-C was the first juice to have this, this box. Now, in order to make this a very sellable and profitable project for them, they did a tie-in with a movie. The movie was Ghostbusters. And this juice was called Ecto-Cooler. And so it had the Slimer on there. So I made this pop-up, and we produced it locally. Now, this was my first time ever doing a pop-up. I had a rubber band in it. It really wasn't very good. It was barely there, barely worked. And the people who would make the pop-up here locally had never done a pop-up either. So there were strings of glue still hanging. It was a bit of a mess. But nevertheless, it still worked.
Uh-huh.
And the illustrator, it was traditional printing. The illustrator was one of our illustrators for Hi-C, and she did the whole thing, the Slimer and stuff. And as she had seen this promotion a few months later from a company that was looking for somebody to do pop-ups, and she said, "Bruce, you need to send that to those people." I went, "Oh, well, I don't know anything about it, really. I'm really not much to it." But okay, so I sent this one thing.
Right.
Months went by. Didn't hear a thing. And I said, okay, I'm just doing my graphic design stuff. Started illustrating some books a few times, a little bit of that on the side. But I got this call one day from the art director of this company in Baltimore. Her name is B. Jackson. B started me on my journey because she said, "I've just started work here, and I found your piece here in this drawer from the previous art director. You'd be interested in freelancing?" "Yeah, I think I can do that. Yeah, that's like fun." She said, "Well, we do really simple pop-ups here." It was really, at first, the pop-ups were all called push-outs. There was nothing glued in at all. You had to design all these tiers of layers, vertical and horizontal, and you would make these, once you open it up, it would push out. And so in between the cracks, you could see the backsides of the other pop-ups. So it was very airy. So I learned a lot because there was a lot of math involved in doing those kind of pop-ups. This has to be this size, and this has to be this size, and this size, and this size, and everything has to match up and has to work out in balance.
And what were the products that you were?
Products were, these were cards, and they were Reader's Digest stocking stuffers at Christmas time. For instance, some of the books would be these little, 5x7 books of the Christmas Carol or Hark the Herald Angel, a nativity scene, things like that. And also did a lot of Beatrix Potter books, some Raggedy Ann and Andy, stuff like that. Eventually, I will tell you this. So we mentioned this earlier. So one of my favorite tools that I use to this day is a ruler that only has inches on one side and picas along one side. Now, people ask today, what is a pica? Pica was a rule, was the measurement that typesetters used to use when they did magazines and newspapers pre-digital era. So this dates me a little bit here, but so this ruler, it was in my first kit for my first graphic design class at the University of Tennessee. And that ruler is my best friend. I use that ruler every day to this day. It's a big old metal ruler, but along one edge are these very clean marks of picas. Now there's 6 to an inch, so it's very, very easy. It's very easy for me to estimate my measurements when I'm doing pop-ups and stuff. And I can say, that's a half. I need to move that a half a pica. And I know exactly what that means in my head. So I can move it a half pica. And before I send it off to press, I convert all the measurements back into either millimeters or inches, depending on where it's going and stuff. But
Now this was also this job, this freelancing for this company in Baltimore was over the phone, through the mail. This was were doing maybe mechanicals and paste ups and
you had to draw all the die lines on a piece of vellum over the artwork. It would be crazy times there toward the, I did that for 7 years. About the fifth year, B had enough power. She really wanted to do more expansive pop-up books. And she was a very, 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 very good book designer.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best I've ever seen. Anyway, so she started pushing. The company was called Ottenheimer Publishers. they're no longer around, but she started pushing them to do better pop-ups where we actually get to glue things in,
right.
You know, glue parts that are in there, you know, instead of just push-outs and stuff. So it got more and more complicated. Well, there were things like, we did a book on Galileo and his telescope, and the illustrator she hired was also in Texas. I've never met the man, but one day he says, well, at that point you had to have the artwork delivered to you because you had to put vellum over the artwork in order to draw the dye lines.
Right.
It wasn't digital. Nothing was digital back then.
Right.
The computers weren't strong enough. There was just not enough technology to support that. So one day there was a knock at the door and UPS was there with this box about the size of a coffee table, a long coffee table, standing on its end. And he sort of shimmied it in through my door because it was so heavy, we couldn't move it otherwise.
Wow.
I opened that thing up and all the artwork was done on wood. It was sheets of wood. So it was super heavy. So I had all this stuff up on my table with the vellum over these giant pieces of wood that he had painted on.
Because of the size? Or it was just the way he worked, too.
He worked big, and he worked
on wood.
You know, wood. So the very, very heavy stuff. But we had to do it that way. You had to put the vellum over and use the rapidograph and draw all the lines. And if you made a mistake, you had to scrape things off or paint them with white out. You know, it was a very tedious way to go about doing those things.
Right.
Now, I also told you I have a second thing that is my secret weapon. And that is a light table. Mm-hmm. When I was freelancing, about the time I started doing the pop-ups, there was an architect in the same building that I was freelancing with, the same place I did the high C pop-up for. One day I walked out, and there's this giant architectural light table sitting next to the dumpster. And I went home, and I grabbed my I had a little Jeep. I got home, went, and that was a 45-minute drive away. Got in my car, came back, and because I needed a car big enough. And there was some guy that was standing there starting to take it out of the dumpster. Oh, no. I've already claimed that. It's mine. I don't know what I'm going to use it for, but it's mine. Uh-huh. So I have this old clunky. It's old, you see?
Uh-huh.
It's all wood. But I can raise it up, and it's got this gigantic light table. It's a good 30 by 35 piece of glass, you know, with lights underneath. Which allows me to actually be pretty efficient when I'm making my models and stuff for the pop-ups. I can print out the dye lines and put them on the glass table and then put my paper down on top of that and see the lines right through. So I can cut with still having a master underneath. So I do one light cut and then I pull the master out and I can cut right through the paper and make all my pieces that I need for the pop-ups. Now, I do have a plotter. It's a Cameo, but the thing is such a pain to work. It's constantly jamming. It's constantly out of register that I hardly ever touch it anymore. I tried for a while. It's just faster for me just to go use my X-Acto knife and cut things out by hand than it is to play around with trying to get this thing to work.
Right.
So I do a lot of that. Now, paper that I use, I've discovered since I use the light table, I have to have a paper that's got pure pulp in it because I can see everything through it. If a lot of paper has clumps of pulp in there, and you don't see it when it's opaque, but when you have a light coming through it, you have, it's like clouds. There's little bits of clouds everywhere getting in your way. You can't see through those. So I found this one paper that I get at a commercial printing house. I'll buy up to 500 sheets at a time. 23 by 35 sheets of Tango. That is a 231 GSM of 10 points, 124 pounds. All those different ways we measure paper.
Crazy.
But it's perfectly clear. It's like just white. It's creamy white, and I can see every line straight through it. Now, my printer can go up to an 11 by 17 when doing things. Now, if I have a project that's larger than that, I have to print them out and overlap, tile them and do things like that. And so then I have to actually glue the artwork down when I'm trying to print something out in color or something. So I have to tile that and mosaic it into place when it's larger than 11 by 17, because that's the largest I can print in here. So I spent a lot of time cutting that large sheet of paper down to 11 by 17. By hand.
Yeah. Right, so, right. I want to ask you a question about, because when we corresponded by email, you mentioned handmade paper and how it can be have these clouds in it, which I totally know about because I make paper by hand, and I'm really interested in watermarks, which are visible when you hold it up to the light. That's so correct. I'm looking for a very clear sheet when forming my watermarks.
But arches and things like that, that's a clear commercial fine art paper. Right. That has watermarks in it as well.
Exactly.
At least one corner, it'll have a watermark.
Yeah, right. So. But I can do artistic watermarks throughout the whole sheet. And
how do you put your watermark in there?
You know how paper's made on a screen?
Mm-hmm.
Like by hand on a screen. So I have a thin rubber material that I cut my design out of. I can cut it by hand or on a plotter. And then I stick it on the screen. So when I make the sheet of paper, it's thinner where the design is poking up into the sheet and thicker everywhere else.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And actually, I'd love to collaborate with you. I think that would be fun to do a pop-up with a watermark sometime.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Going off script a little bit, but.
So I've seen a book recently that someone did where it's all cutouts and you use a flashlight and you shine the shadows on the wall. That was an idea that I had years ago and didn't know how to pull it off. Didn't really think about it. But if we did a book that had some watermarks hidden in the paper and you backlit it or something.
With light. Yeah, light would be an element for sure.
Yes.
Whether it's user activated just in a window or a flashlight. I did one book with hand shadows and a flashlight. Anyways, you mentioned the handmade paper thing. Have you ever tried handmade papers in your pop-ups?
I've never tried it. No.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen it in process, but I haven't. Except that, early on when I was first getting into children's books, there was an artist who uses handmade paper. Is it Fleming?
Denise Fleming.
Yeah,
She's an illustrator.
She came to a meeting that I went to, and she was demonstrating how the process worked. I thought that was fascinating. Because one of the other things, I belong to two important organizations.
Yeah.
One is the Movable Book Society. We'll talk about that more in a minute. But I also am a longtime member of the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. And I learn a lot about children's books through that organization. It's a very open, it's international now. They have conferences and they have speakers and you learn the business. You learn how to present your books to publishers, how to get an agent, all those kind of things.
Right.
Never had an agent myself, but if you're that kind of an artist or that kind of writer, it's an organization for you. It's a great organization. And if you have one in your town or anywhere near you,
so there are chapters around the country.
There are lots of chapters.
Yeah.
In Texas, we have four or five.
Oh, wow.
Louisiana has one. It depends on the size of the state, you know, population.
Right.
So I've spent the last 7 or 8 years being the webmaster for that organization and the Houston chapter. I did their newsletter and stuff. It's much simpler than I do for the Movable Book Society.
Yeah, we will get to the Movable Book Society, but I want to go back and hear you tell me about how you sort of the transition from the old school way of doing pop-ups to what you're doing today with technology.
Sure. Okay, so I have to talk about one second here. It's go back to 1997 or so. Jackson told me about, have you ever heard of the Movable Book Society? And I went, no, what is that? And he said, it's an organization of pop-up people. You should join that and go to it. Okay, well, I really didn't have much. I'd only worked for them at that point. They had a meeting coming up in New York, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And I went up there and my plane came in late. This is a great little story. My plane came in late, lost my luggage, and the thing was supposed to kick off on Friday night, Saturday, Sunday kind of a thing. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So I got there, and I just called them, and I said, look, I'm not going to make it. There was a big trip into the city, into New York City, to go to an antiquarian book sale, you know, old books and things like that. And I said, well, I can't do that. I'll just see you guys tomorrow. Well, I finally got my luggage. I'm standing out on the curb about to call for a taxi. And this giant Greyhound bus pulls up. Door opens up. And this guy steps off and he goes, hey, are you Bruce? And I went, yeah. He says, get on this bus. And I've got on this bus. We're going into town. You're coming with us. Okay. So I go and I sit down next to this guy. And he says, I like your work. Cause I saw the Gutenberg's Gift book had been rated in the Movable Book Society's newsletter.
Oh, okay.
And he said, I like your book. And I said, great. Thank you. I appreciate that. My first book, you know, kind of thing to do. And he said, well, I'm Robert Sabuda. And I went, oh, that's cool. That's cool. So are you a collector?
So you didn't know him. Yeah.
Not knowing who he was.
Right.
He had just started his meteoric climb, you know, to the top of the heap. But during that visit, we were just sitting around talking, and I was talking to him, and this man walked in, really tall, elegant man from South America. Back then, the pop-up books were made in Colombia and at a printer called Carval. And this man's name is Guillermo. He walks in, he's got this brown paper book wrapped in brown paper, and he walks over and hands it to very delicately and reverentially to Robert. Robert rips it open and he looks at this book and he opens it, and I'm watching, looking over his shoulder, and he's smiling and he hands it to me. I'm the second person to ever touch an actual printed copy of The 12 Days of Christmas.
Uh-huh.
And that book is still to this day my favorite pop-up book of all time. That mm-hmm. book was, it's elegant. The artwork is clever. It's really well done. Uses color in just the right ways. Lots of white. Beautiful, beautiful book. So Guillermo said, Bruce, I've seen some of your work. You really should, you know, talk to people in New York. And mm-hmm. I know this lady at Simon & Schuster, who does a lot of pop-ups now. She was a big supporter of Robert Sabuda and helped him get his foot in the door. Even Robert had to go through a lot of rejections at first before he found mm-hmm. a publisher who believed in what he was doing. Shame on those other publishers.
Yeah, anyway, they lost out.
He said, you need to meet Robin Corey. She's the editor or chief editor or whatever her title was. Well, there was a convention, the ABA convention in Chicago. I flew up. No, it was in New York again. So I went up there, and she had lots of meetings and stuff. And I would ask around, where's Robin? I go into the booth, Simon & Schuster booth. Where's, well, she's in meetings. So I would set out I just sat outside this meeting room until finally she came out, and I saw her name tag. And I said, Robin, Guillermo recommended me. And I handed her my card, which was not a pop-up card. It was just mm-hmm. a card. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, okay, thanks. She put it in her pocket. Never heard from her again for 2 years. 2 years later, I get a telephone call from her. And she said, would you be interested in doing a book for Simon & Schuster? And I said, absolutely, I would. And so that started my publishing career in New York. And the book was Little Red Riding Hood. Uh-huh. And it was a beautiful experience. That's about the time that we transitioned to the computer.
Okay.
With that book, because the illustrator was a Caldecott nominee illustrator. Her name escapes me at the moment, but she did Zin Zin Violin, and she was nominated for that book. And she did the illustrations for this, and she would send these things to me digitally. And I was the first time I walked on the computer, because back then the computers had these little teeny tiny screens.
Right.
There wasn't much. You had to scroll around a lot. And, you know, you were lucky if your computer had more than, 500 megabytes of power?
I don't even remember. Yeah.
Yeah, it was awful back then. But it was a start. We were fascinated. That's when I first started.
Uh-huh. And did you just teach yourself, learn as you went, or?
Oh, that's an interesting story, too. When B started telling me, she says, hey, would you be interested in doing this? I went, I need to learn more about this. So I started going to bookstores, and I would go through the sale bins, and I would buy pop-up books that were damaged. Mostly a lot of National Geographic ones that Intervisual Books in California had created.
Right.
I didn't know any of this stuff. I didn't know any of who these people were, these companies, nothing. That was a blank slate. So I would take and I would, you know, very delicately slice open the pages, look inside, figure out how they did things. I call it doing book autopsies, you know, reverse engineer. Uh-huh. And so I would do that. And I slowly, over the time of my time with Oppenheimer, learned how to do these. And even today, you know, you want to keep teaching yourself new things. So I'm constantly watching what other paper engineers are doing, and I share things with them. And it's a very, very friendly community. Mm-hmm. And we help each other out a lot. So there's a lot of trust inside this community. And so we help each other and we teach each other and we say, you know, have you tried this technique? Somebody asks you, what do you think about this? And you say, well, have you thought about it this way? Here's another hint I will tell you for any paper engineers, aspiring paper engineers who are wanting to come up. Just like when you're becoming a children's book writer or illustrator, you want to learn from the best. Mm-hmm. So it's called mentor text. You buy books, you read them, you learn to figure out how they wrote the books. You figure out how they illustrate the books. Same thing happens with paper engineers. Now, to learn this, you might do what I did was the autopsies. But one technique that I like to point out to young paper engineers is to take these books that you like. So you have an idea for a pop-up. You got a basic idea in your head what you want it to do. How do I get there? How do I make this happen? Well, start flipping through some of these other pop-up books. And once you flip through them once, close the book, turn it upside down, and flip through it again. Mm-hmm. You'll see it in an entirely different way. The mechanisms will look different to you now.
Yeah.
You can start imagining, instead of that branch coming down, that's the tail on my animal.
Right.
And you start figuring out, oh, we can look at it this way. Look at them in the mirror. So they're backwards. Anything you can do to change your perspective so that you're not copying what that paper engineer or artist has done, you're being inspired by what they've done. So I find myself a lot of times I'll start a project and I have a really good idea of where I want it to go, but sometimes I go, I don't know. So I will do that. I'll flip through books and turn them upside down and study and imagine what my pieces would look like if I change things.
Right.
And work my way through some of those. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good tip I wanted to give you. Anybody wanting to do paper engineering. Study for pop-up books, but change your perspective. Don't copy them. Be inspired by them.
Like that. Right, right. Yeah, and there's still today aren't many places in school to learn about paper engineering. It's amazing.
No, there's not. And, you know, I self-taught. I know Pratt University has a semester class. And a lot of the paper engineers that you know today were professors there. Robert did, Matthew did, Simon's doing it now. Right. Simon Arisbe. And Kyle Ullman was a teacher there for a while at Pratt. But you have to be a Pratt student, I think, to take the class.
Right.
And there's a school in Ohio, I think, has some paper engineering things. Washington University.
Okay. Yeah.
I think they do paper engineering. But for the most part, there's not a lot of paper engineering classes to be taken out there. And that's a real shame. Well, you know, it's a small world. You know, there's approximately 100 paper engineers that are working in the world. Mm-hmm. And many of them only do it every great once in a while. Right. So there's only, you know, 25 or 30 people in America and Europe and now China who do this on a regular basis. So not very many.
Right.
So, but then we're having a bit of it started before the pandemic. We're having a bit of less interest from publishers for pop-ups than we used to have. Profit margin shrank.
Right.
Books got more expensive. Labor costs went up. Shipping during the pandemic has been absolutely horrendous. And it's really dunk a lot. So my career. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to, I want to ask you about one of your favorite projects and kind of take me through.
Okay. So
process.
Well, I'll tell you my very favorite project I ever did was the Harry Potter pop-up book. And I did that with Inside Editions. And that was great. They would have Warner Brothers would send me sketches. I would send them sketches. We'd go back and forth, and we planned a book out. So that book is still my most successful book. It's in its seventh printing now, and so I'd still like to show that when I'm giving speeches and presentations.
Right.
But a few years ago, a man named Paul Zellon approached me. Paul Zellon was one of the founders of a pop-up card company in the 70s called Pop Shots.
Oh, yeah.
Pop Shots eventually was bought by Up With Paper.
Right,
And Monica Brandrup and, and Eugene Kim and Yevgenia. All those people work there. I did a lot. I did 75 or so cards for Up With Paper over the years.
Okay.
But anyway, so Paul was one of the founders of that. And he said, his company is more into electronics in things. He would do a lot of battery and light inserts into projects. They didn't have to be books. They could be puzzles. They could be gloves. They could be wands. They could be anything. But he had a good relationship with Universal Studios, which is where the Wizarding World of Harry Potter is.
Right.
And so we embarked on a project. So the two of us went down there, and I'd never been to the Wizarding World. I was fascinated. Because I loved Harry Potter anyway. So I read the first four entire novels to my kids at bedtime. So
we've
always been Harry Potter fans. So I just loved it. But I took lots of photographs, and I figured out and mapped it and everything else. And I came back home to here in Houston, and I spent 2 whole months working on nothing but this. Now, you can see this if you go to my Instagram page, which is instagram.com/BFPOP, P-O-P. So if you go there, you'll see this. So basically, this is a pop-up. If you open it two times, you open it lengthwise, and then you open it again sideways. And the entire Wizarding World of Harry Potter pops up.
Wow.
Including the Hogwarts castle at the end and all the buildings and all the places you can buy things, and everything is there and in the right places, which is why it took so long, because, you know, pop-ups have to work across certain places in a book.
Right.
That's why the strongest part in a pop-up book is in across the gutter. That's the strongest place to put a pop-up. So I would have to create little false gutters and things all the way through this to make things pop up in odd places. So it took a lot of time to work on all that. So Paul and I went back down there, and we presented it to the people who purchased things for sale in their gift shops and things. Went, this is a slam dunk. This is great. I mean, it's really one of my most shining achievements. You know,
yeah.
You'll see. Go take a look at it. But so they went, oh my God, we love this. We're never going to do this. It's awfully complicated and it's awfully big.
Oh no.
So they didn't buy it. They liked it.
Yeah.
They liked it a lot. But they said, no, we can't do that. And I said, well, what if we just keep it in the box and we put a little video on top and it shows what it does? Well, we can't do that because Wizarding World has to be in character. You have to be in the Wizarding World of Harry Potter the entire time. Videos are not allowed. So you can't do anything like that. Anyway, so that was one of my great projects that I just loved and wish that we could go in production. Maybe one of these days.
Maybe someday things will change.
Maybe someday they'll get around to doing it. But now
did you have a contract? Did you get paid for the work you did?
Yeah, Paul did give me an advance on that.
All right, good.
I can't work for free.
No, right.
it's tough, you know. I get approached with a lot of people who have ideas for pop-up books. And so I always tell them, let's just talk about it for a few minutes and let's make sure this is a pop-up book. This should be a pop-up book.
Right.
And do you really understand what you're getting yourself into pop-up book wise?
Right.
Because you have to think about a pop-up book in the way that you build a house.
Mm-hmm.
You have to hire an architect. Mm-hmm. You have to draw plans. You have to create the very first version of it. That's even before you've even thought about going to press.
Right.
Getting it printed. So there's a lot of upfront costs in doing a pop-up book. So I explain that to a lot of people, and most of them back away very cautiously.
Yeah.
As if I just showed them a snake, you know?
Right.
But I get a lot of projects that way from companies, corporations who have deeper pockets.
Right.
They're not scared of that. They're going to print enough, and they have reasons for wanting these besides, I just want to make a pop-up book, you know? So you have to understand, first of all, every once in a while, I do run across a story that somebody has that would make a good pop-up book. Most of them, I would say, you probably should make sure it works as it's just a good story first before you try to think about it that way. But pop-up books have their own kind of little rules and realities. There has to be a cadence. There has to be a reason why you're doing it in a pop-up form.
Right.
It's an intrinsic part of the book. So it can't just be, I want to take my story and turn it into pop-ups.
Yeah, that's talk about that really a little works. More. Like, do you have an example of one that wouldn't work and one that would?
Well, sometimes it's just a story. Like, there's a story about a cat, you know, my cat does this, my cat travels, and my cat has had all the experiences. And it's a great story for this little cat. But I said, you know, the story is longer than seven spreads. So what you want in a pop-up book, you really want to have is like six or seven wow moments.
Oh, I see.
And, and that justifies the structure of the book. Now you can flesh it out with gatefolds and smaller pop-ups, things like that, if the story needs it. But it has to be a strong story that's necessary for it. You know, you can think about the simplest things that make great pop-up books are alphabet books or counting to 10 books. There's been tons of those made. Makes it harder to get a new one now because there's so many have been done, but it made sense. Mm-hmm. You could control it. It had a reason. You could say, well, this one's going to pop up as this animal. This two is going to be two pop-ups, you know, two things. You can make a case. Mm-hmm. But if it's just a story, what you have to think about, well, why do you want to do this as a pop-up when it really should be just a children's book?
Right.
So it has to have a reason for being a pop-up. So when I do get a project that is pop-up, so one of two things happens. Either I'm given a manuscript and they say, what do you think? And we're going to pair you with this illustrator. Because I get paired with lots of illustrators.
Mm-hmm.
I'm known more as a paper engineer than illustrator. Changing some of that. But I get paired with a lot. And I work with illustrators very well. And that's a lot of that becomes because of my art directing background, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of most paper engineers get into this because they're illustrators and they have an idea of how to turn the illustrations into pop-ups. And they want to do that. And they learn how to do this. For me, it wasn't that way. Pop-ups for me are magic, just pure magic and sculpture. When I failed to mention when I discovered the pop-ups way back when I was doing those simple ones, I was going, I can actually take flat graphic design and turn it into three dimensions. And I love sculpture. That was the magic moment for me. I realized I could turn things three dimensional and still use the skills that I had already developed. So I can work with illustrators. So if either an illustrator comes with me with a good idea, for instance, I did several books with Chuck Fisher. Chuck would always come to me with a really good, solid idea for what the pop-up would be. Most of the time when I work on a new project, it's up to me to come up with the concept of what the pop-up is going to be.
So you read the manuscript and you start envisioning in your head, no, that's not going to work, or yes, that is.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I start doing thumbnails and thinking about what this is going to be and what those aha moments should be and stuff. And I said, just give me a sample of the illustrator's work so I know what kind of things they do. Do they do realistic? Do they do cartoonish? Do they do things where heads are twice as big as the bodies? I need to know those kind of things as I'm planning this out. But beyond that, I will come up with the sketches and stuff. Mm-hmm. Then I will take and I will start working roughs with the paper itself.
Mm-hmm.
I start experimenting, and I will take and I've figured out a basic direction I want this pop-up to go in. So I start building it. And And there's lots of changes you make while you're doing this. It's just, it's a journey.
Yeah.
Making
a
pop-up book is a journey. You just don't wake up and go, oh, I know exactly how this is going to work. I mean, years and years and years of experience, you can do some of that. But it's even more, it's more fun for us with all this experience to still make it a journey, because you're still trying to challenge yourself and to do something different that you haven't done before. So I work on making these really rough dummies. And I show the little movies or a photograph to the publisher, whoever I'm working with, and say, do you like the way this is going? And I get their feedback.
Is this then just a white dummy?
They're just white with maybe pencil sketches, so you know what that shape is. You know, just really rough kind of stuff. And a lot of, and especially when I'm working with people who are not in the publishing industry, like corporations and stuff, they go, what am I looking at? That's a mess. Right. Is that what I'm paying you for? Is this mess? No. It's going to get better. I promise. It's going to get better. It just takes a little while to get there.
You don't
want to go in and start nailing things down before you know exactly where you want it to be.
You got to
take it easy at first. Keep it loose. You know, you just want to take your time a little bit here. So I start working these. I take them apart and I trace out the pieces, hone them up a little bit because I want them to make sure that they work, and I will send those to the illustrator.
Right.
And I said, here's a picture of what it's going to look like when it's done, the form, but here's all the pieces, because all you got to do is illustrate the pieces. Don't have to worry about how it goes together or how this works or anything like that. You don't have to. That's what I do.
Right. But do they have a problem? They're having to take it apart in their head like you did.
No,
you did that.
They do in a way, but they basically have every little piece. There's the arm piece, and there's the leg piece, and there's the head piece, and there's the mountain piece, and they have all of those. And generally, I can say, okay, listen, the only thing I want to, if you want to give me pencils first, that's fine, and we'll talk about color later, because there are color issues. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that the color of one piece that's sitting in front of another works with that piece.
Yeah, gosh.
Kind of thing. Yeah. The hardest part is telling them not to paint arms on their characters because the arms have to be a separate piece. They're moving, you know. They go, why am I? No, I don't do it that way. Well, you're going to now. You are. So, because the problem is that sometimes they will come to me with a finished painting and can you turn this into a pop-up?
Now, even
publishers have done that to me.
Yeah.
I had two books that were definitely done that way. One was understandable. It was a book for Sports Illustrated kids. And they only do photography. So they would send me a photograph and I'd have to deconstruct it into a pop-up.
Oh, wow.
Well, why is that a problem? Well, it's a problem because you're taking people apart and you're moving them around in the picture.
Right.
So if you take somebody and move them, what's behind them?
Right.
Well, you got to figure that out. And since you're the artist as well, you've got to figure out how to get that filled that didn't used to be there.
Oh my gosh.
You got to deconstruct. You got to do lots of Photoshop work. Same thing happened was when I did Puff the Magic Dragon. They sent me the original paintings from the still book, and I broke it all down into pop-up form, and had to Photoshop all that together as well. So lots of work. It's always better if we can start with the sketches and teach the illustrator to follow through. So they give me back their paintings. I scan them into my computer. Everything becomes digital at that point, and I make all the files that need to go to the printer.
Right.
And the printer understands. Most of the printers are, of course, are in Asia, either China or Thailand, Vietnam, more these days. But they're very good at understanding what we need them to do. So it's a big process. But.
Right. Yeah, it's a way bigger process than we can go into detail, but it's fascinating to hear about. I'm curious, since you know pretty much everybody in the field, whether there's ever been a project that you like, do you just like to go out on a limb, take any project, or have you ever recommended someone else because you felt they would do a better job or for whatever reason?
Yes, that has happened.
Granted,
I like challenges, and I generally try to take on the project. Generally, when I take a project and recommend somebody else, it's probably because I'm just too busy to take it on.
Yeah,
because I like to take on challenges, and the busier I am, the happier I am.
Right.
But I have done that. Sure.
For
projects.
Right.
And I've gotten recommendations from other paper engineers as well. Said, would help out. Yeah. I'd love to do that project instead of that.
Yeah. Right. Right. Cool. Yeah. And we mentioned the Movable Book Society, which is a wonderful organization that we're both members of. And you're the editor of the newsletter now. And just tell us a little bit about that. I love how, I mean, this was like a paper black and white thing you got in the mail for years and years, and you've turned it into a wonderful online publication.
Well, at the 25th anniversary conference was in Kansas City.
Yeah.
And the founder of the organization was Ann Montanaro Staples.
Mm-hmm.
And she, wonderful. She created this community. She brought us all together. She educated us. She brought all these people to collectors. She brought historians. She brought paper engineers, illustrators, all of us together. So we got to know each other, and she supported this community. It was just terrific what she did. But she also put this newsletter together. And of course, over 25 years, you see the technology back then, like we didn't do things digitally. She didn't either. And it just sort of kept that way. It would be a saddle stitched, sometimes color, but mostly black and white newsletter. So at this conference, she announced that she was retiring. I gave the keynote at that address, mm-hmm. 25th mm-hmm. anniversary. But also, at this point in my career, it's time to start giving back mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And I'd always been more independent. And even though I was a member, I was sort of like, always stayed in the shadows in the background. And when she retired, I said, you know, with my knowledge of what's going on in the pop-up world, but also my skills as a graphic designer and art director through the years, because I still do that kind of stuff on the side too, would come in handy here. So I talked to Sean and said, would you be interested in letting me take over this? And Sean talked to Ann, and the both of them went, oh, absolutely, take it. Please, take it. it's a lot of work. Yeah. I said, well, I'm going to take it over. You know, one of the problems that I did have with the newsletter was that it was limited. The pictures had to be, you had a certain amount of pages you could print, and the pictures had to be small. They were often black and white. But also, they're the links to things that are on the internet. They would all be typed out in all these little codes, and you'd have to very meticulously type out every little code if you wanted to go to that link.
Right.
I said, you know, we could take this and make it automatic. And we can also really start celebrating the visuals that this art form has if we take this online. So I started working in InDesign and put the magazine together. And then I filter it through a website called Issue, ISSUU.com. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And lots of people use this for this thing, but it allows me to go in there and not only have automatic hyperlinks that you can click on, but it turns the page for you in an animation. So you're like, you're watching a magazine unfold on there on screen, and I can put movies in.
Yeah.
There.
I love
it. So now you can actually see the pop-ups happening. If you click on it, you can see a little movie of the pop-ups. Not everything has a movie, but I try to get at least five or six or more into each issue.
Yeah.
And it also gave me a chance to, you know, bring it into the century and give it some design, lots of color, high resolution photographs, the movies, of course, the hyperlinks, of course, but also a lot of more in-depth background in some of these stories, because I can make, as long as there's the magazine is divisible by four, it's just a print, because we also print some of these for people who want them to be printed. It has to work in multiples of four. That's the way magazines are put together.
Right.
So I can make as many multiples of four as I want. And it just depends on how much time I want to put into it, how big I want to make photographs, what quality photographs I have for that issue, what kind of contributions people have written in and given me for material.
Right.
Sometimes there's very little that's been given in, and I'm faced with a magazine and I've got to fill the whole thing myself, which I've done a couple of times. But that's also been fun too, because I get to go into and start researching. Yeah. I spend a lot of time on this when I do it.
I'm sure you do. Yeah.
So this is a quarterly magazine, and it can take a good 2 weeks work to make this each issue, you know, come together. But it's a fun thing, I think it's a wonderful evolution of the original newsletter, and I have so much fun. It allows me to explore history. It allows me to explore contemporary paper engineers. Mm-hmm. Let people get to know these people a little bit better than just their book.
Right.
Find out who they are, how they tick. You know, what their background is, and what they're planning next. Other countries. Our last issue was all about France.
Right. Right.
France is a wonderful market with a whole different approach to these things. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for doing that. And listeners, if you're interested in the Movable Book Society, I'll put a link in the show notes. And we have a biannual conference in a different city. And this publication is part of the membership. And actually, I think quarterly online gatherings as well now. So
Yes, that's right. Sean leads us. Oh, Sean, and by the way, after 2 years of moratorium, the issues are only available for members for 2 years. After the 2 year window, each issue comes into the public domain. So now there's three. There's four of the original issues that I put together are available for anyone to view. So we can start spreading the word.
Oh, and where is that? The Smithsonian or something?
Online. If you go to the movablebooksociety.org on the newsletter page, the three and now soon to be four oldest entries on the page are now opening without a password.
So you can check it out. Anyone can check it out. Wonderful.
Yes.
Okay, well, we need to wrap up, but I want to hear a little bit about what you're working on right now.
A couple of commercial projects.
Mm-hmm.
I have one I'm doing for a jewelry chain. It's of some wedding rings that are tied to a Formula One racing thing here. So you see up here, you can see it, Helen.
Yeah. Barely.
There's a bride and groom sitting on the back of a car, of a race car.
Yeah.
See that from over there? Probably not. Here. So this is in production right now.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And then I've got a couple of other little projects like that, but right at the moment I'm starting to do some nonfiction books of my own, something I've been toying around with. The first one is going to be a pop-up book of the world's deadliest snakes. I'm working on that, illustrating, writing, and the whole thing. I've done lots of research on snakes and things like that. And then I have a couple of other ideas for follow-up books as well. But I've taken a few conference workshops and things through Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators for nonfiction books, and picture books and things like that. So I'm learning new things all the time myself. And so it's being in a creative industry like this, you're constantly challenging yourself and constantly learning new things.
Yeah,
and that's how you grow, you know, and you keep trying.
Yeah, it keeps you excited too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I love
I'm
that.
Lucky.
Yeah.
You know, you're lucky. Oh, I'm lucky. We get to do something that we really love to do.
Yeah, we are so lucky.
I also want to just mention that I spend a lot of time visiting schools. I go to elementary schools a lot during the school year.
Mm-hmm.
I've done hundreds and hundreds of presentations. And to bring these books to these children who've never seen these before, it's so much fun. They enjoy it. It's like a big giant party, magic show, art show. It's so much fun. And the students love it. And it doesn't matter what age group they are, all the way up through sixth grade.
Yeah.
They're still interested in this, and it works really, really well.
How do you organize that? Do you just go back to the same schools like every year, or?
I reach out to the librarians throughout Texas. Texas is really good about librarians will bring people in.
Okay.
So I've done three or four school districts on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And every year I reach out to two or three other around the state.
Yeah.
So.
And then what about?
Reaching out and trying to get invitations.
Uh-huh. And your snake book and those other projects, do you have, will that be published? Will you self-publish?
Do not know yet.
You're just,
do not know. Like anybody else, this would be a project that I will have to find a publisher for.
Pitch.
Like any other book, person with a book idea.
Right.
But hopefully, you know, somebody will like it and we'll have it published.
Right.
That's my hope.
Right. And where can we find you online, Bruce?
Paperpops.com is my website, and you can find me on Instagram at instagram.com/bfpop. Just kind of
right.
I gave myself years ago.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Helen, it was so much fun, and I hope everyone enjoyed it, and it's half as much as I did.
Yeah, take care.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season, the making paper.